Hey everybody, welcome to Magical Musings. Brian and Joy are here once again, and we're going to be talking for the next 2 hours on all topics pagan and mystical and the 201 stuff that the books never hit. So come on in and join us, and we're going to have lots of fun. Tonight's episode is episode number 13, and we're going to be talking about spellcrafting and some of the advanced knowledge about that. So, hi everyone.
How's it going, folks?
All right. Listen, Brian had somebody contact him a couple of days ago, so go ahead and let us know about that.
Yeah, one of my followers on my blog has apparently been concerned with a... I want to guess from the context that it's like an ex-boyfriend or something, who she feels has been really invasive in her life. And I said, well... what we can do is, you know, discuss basic spellcraft, protection spells and the like. And so I gave her a bunch of information about basic spell casting and amulets and, you know, crystals and that sort of thing. And then she came back at me with a message saying, my friend recommended this book about creating magical entities to guard your property and yourself. And I kind of was like... She said to me that she was a little bit hesitant and a little bit concerned about, you know, doing this kind of thing. And I said, well, that's probably a good indicator that you're not ready for it. And then she messaged me again saying, well, I know you said that you, you know, if you're a little hesitant or worried about doing it, that you shouldn't, but, and then I was like, no, just steer clear of the advanced stuff. Until you figured out how to do the basic stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's always a sage piece of advice, and it's one that nobody ever pays attention to. Listen, anytime you start any pathways on anything and start a new skill, you got to learn the basic stuff first, and then you can jump into the advanced stuff. I mean, magic seems like it's really, really easy. You sit down, you visualize some things, you light a couple candles, and that's about it. But it's actually a heck of a lot more than that, and it's a lot more, behind-the-scenes stuff. I mean, okay, let's look at this from the perspective of another craft. We'll say carpentry, okay, woodworking in particular. It seems really easy to just sit down with a piece of wood and a sharp knife and you carve out a nice design on the piece of wood and it looks beautiful. Yep. Okay, so that's easy once you've been doing it 20 years. But there's a lot of preparatory work going into that. You got to learn how to draw. You have to learn to draw well. You have to learn how to carve just so that you're not digging too deep, taking too much wood out, but taking just enough. You got to learn how to sharpen your tools to make sure that they're not following the grain of the wood, which takes the carver into different areas. And there's going to be, you know, times when they're going to fail, when they're going to be carving this piece of wood out, the chisel's going to slip, and they're going to go, oh shit, because now this piece is ruined, and they have to throw it away, and start over. I mean,
true.
You know, there's all this work that has to go in on the back end so that they can get the nice presentation piece on the front end for you to see. It's the same thing with magic. You got lots and lots of time devoted to crafting the skills, practicing them, making sure that you know what's going on, what exactly is happening, where you messed up, where you didn't mess up, and how to fix errors. Because when you start talking about things like spells and entities, you're talking about a living being that you've just created that you are responsible for, that if you've screwed up on, you now have to fix.
It's true. And actually, your little analogy brings to mind two cards of the tarot that actually pertain to this particular topic.
The eight and the three of pentacles, right?
Exactly.
Yes, the from before in our tarot talk, we would talk about this quite a lot. The Eight of Pentacles and the Three of Pentacles show pretty much the exact same scene, except at different time periods. The Eight of Pentacles is a young boy sitting down carving out pentacles on wood. Well, the Three of Pentacles is this older, middle-aged gentleman who is in the process of making like 12 or 13 different things in the progress of the picture on there that is him carving in wood. And what people don't realize is that the eight is a previous state of the three, and that you do have to practice, and that you do have to learn it first before you can make the super master class pretty things that everybody goes gaga for.
Exactly. And besides, I mean, when you're young, you know, when you're new to something, you do want to spend time making the little mistakes that help you advance, as opposed to jumping into something that you're not ready for and just, you know, completely fucking it up. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, if you're hiring yourself out as a new, you know, eager little woodworker to carve the altar at a church or something, and they're willing to lay down, you know, 50 grand for a masterpiece, and you haven't got past the, you know, sanding the edges on a basic plank, you know, they're going to be kind of pissed off that they wasted that much money on you. Mm-hmm. So,
and they'll probably refuse to pay, and then you've wasted your time and your effort and your energy and materials. You know, and another really good analogy that we can come up with this is music. You don't sit down, pick up a 12-string guitar, and start playing like Eric Clapton. I mean, you just don't. There's lots and lots and lots of time where you're spending learning the basic chords and how to move and playing a sixth string and learning which combinations of things, and then you can experiment and move on from there, you know? So it's, exactly. You know, you got to learn the basics. So since we started on talking about the basics and we've given all the dire warnings, we're going to talk about we're going to talk about some basics of spellcraft first. Then we're going to move on from there and talk about some of the more advanced stuff. And then we're going to probably wind up talking about the things that should be happening, what's going on in the background, what is actually occurring. Because a lot of this touches on a lot of the things that we've already talked about. Okay, magic is not just an energy field created by all living things which surrounds us, penetrates us, and binds the galaxy together, which is actually one of the best descriptions that I've ever heard for it, straight out of Star Wars, but it works, because that's exactly what this magical energy is. It touches on every single plane of existence. If you give credence to the theory of multiple dimensions, it touches on every single living thing that there is. It touches on the entire multiverse. And you start being able to manipulate these things and cause changes to occur simply because you want them to. Which is, you know, Aleister Crowley's basic description of magic. Magic is the art and science of causing change to occur in conformity with will. Okay, that is what it is in its most basic definition. And you have to really realize that you're not just talking about your own little area, although most magicians tend to focus on themselves and tend to focus on improving themselves. Because when you're talking about making a change on a global scale, it starts becoming, you know, really something that you've got to stop and consider for a minute. I do this change here, and it's going to cause these ripples, and it's going to cause this problem, and it's going to cause this effect over here with somebody that has no comprehension of what's been going on. It's called the butterfly effect.
I was just thinking that.
Exactly. I mean, it's a well-known way of looking at the interconnectedness of everything. The theory goes that if a butterfly in Sedona, Arizona, flaps her wings, that moves the air a little bit. Well, that transfers a little energy over there, and that gives this, and this picks up this pollen and that. And as a result of the butterfly flapping its wings, you get a hurricane in the Pacific. And it's the way it's laid out is very logical, and it's very, you can start seeing the interconnectedness. But we've, you know, demonstrated this multiple times, not only on our show, but in real life. Let's think about wars in another nation and how they're directly affecting us, even though we're not living in that area. I mean, just consider that for a second, and how, because Afghanistan is now free, they are affecting our lives in a direct manner. Okay, and you know, whatever definition you want to use for Afghanistan, because it's not free and it's, you know, whatever, you know, apply that and understand that the things that are happening there are affecting your life here.
Well, and I think that's best illustrated too in the fact that since 9/11, for instance, you've had an increase in border security all over the world, you know, and there have been more troops sent into battle, you know, in far corners of the world. Like, I mean, I even just think about a TV show that Canada has called Border Security, which, mm-hmm. strangely enough, is a show about borders. The border.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's become incredibly complicated to get across the border into Canada now, whereas when I was a kid, you could just show like a driver's license from Canada or the U.S. and jump back and forth as easy as you like.
There were places where you could cross the street.
That's true, actually. There's actually a little town in southern B.C. that basically straddles the border, and, mm-hmm. and you used to be able to just sort of walk over and...
Yeah, go to your friend's house and you're, you know, invading another country.
Exactly. And now, I mean, they just assume that you're a terrorist, you know, if you are slightly quirky, you know, and then they'll put you through the paces. But nonetheless, I mean, basically, the idea is that, yes, little things in faraway places can affect you day to day.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate reality is that that's what happens with a interconnected world, you know.
And this gets multiplied when you start applying it to energy fields. Okay, mm-hmm. the physical of not having this dad here in this family because he's deployed over in Afghanistan, protecting somebody else's children, gets magnified when you start talking about the energy that you are putting into this desire to bring you money from the multiverse, you know, and then start thinking of all of the potential effects that it could have. If you just took $1 off of everybody, that $1 isn't probably going to be missed by most people. Okay, but suddenly you're going to get what, $7 billion dumping on you? But that $1 for somebody that has an income of 30 cents a day in Africa is a significant amount. You know, mm-hmm. for Western civilizations, it's nothing, a dollar, you know, it's, what, 100 pennies, 100 pence? Nothing, you know. But for somebody where that's, you know, a week's worth of wages, that's how they're supporting their family, that's a lot of money. So, you know, this little bit of energy that you're putting in to improve you could be taking the same amount of energy away from somebody else. And if they're on an energy poor world, or if they're, you know, trying and working to improve themselves, there you go. Okay, it's the same thing. So you have to, this is one of the hidden meanings of do as you will. It's one of those things where you have to consider the potential consequences and be ready to deal with those potential consequences where it's actually injuring somebody. Now, if you can make it so that it doesn't injure somebody else, great. But the reality is that in most instances, it's going to hurt someone. Go for it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the sort of principal concepts in any spell working or any kind of transaction, really, in the economic world even, is the concept that nature maintains a balance. You know, you can't have more of something in one area without taking it away from somewhere else.
Exactly.
It's nice to think in terms of reducing the collateral damage you're going to do with your spell work. And it's actually something that I was watching Earthsea the other day because I had it in mind to do. And one of the points that the instructors on the Island of Roke, which is the wizard school, he's driving home the point that, you know, you can't do any spell work unless you've considered all the consequences, good and bad, of what you're doing. Because otherwise you don't know what you're going to unleash.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the same, you know, the butterfly concept, basically, is, you know, it's like if you're going to zap someone with a curse. I actually was talking about it the other day on my blog as well. And the way I put it was that if you zap someone, what you're forgetting is that everything is interrelated on a different level of reality. And the harm you're trying to do to someone else is actually affecting you as well.
Mm-hmm. And to lay it out for those that don't understand the concept really easily, here's the thing. You have to gather negative energy in any curse, okay, in any zap like that. You have to put a lot of anger and a lot of malice and a lot of desire for them to be hurt into a spell like that. Okay. Well, in the act of gathering all of that, you get contaminated by it. Just like if you were picking up, a butterfly. You pick up the butterfly very easily by the wings. Well, you get all that dust all over your fingers. Okay. Even though you've let the butterfly go, that dust is still on you and you can't really get it off. Easily. You have to go to a couple of lengths, washing your hands, in order to do it. You can't just wipe it off on your clothes. It's the same thing for these kinds of spells. So because you have all of that on you, all that negative energy, that's going to set up a vibration in the astral planes, in the multiverse, that acts as a beacon for more negativity.
And the interesting thing, too, with that is that if you do touch a butterfly's wings and the scales do get on your fingers, you're actually harming the butterfly as well because they require those things for flight.
Mm-hmm. You know, so there you go. You know, there's a blatant description of what's happening with, hexing somebody like that. Now, there are times when you can act as... I don't know, I guess the universe's karma machine, and give somebody what they deserve. But you always have to be very, very careful that it is what they deserve, what they've earned. I know I've had a few instances where I've been really mad at somebody. I've done a spell to get somebody back for what they did to me. I cast it so that they would get exactly what they deserve, and they improved in their life, which was kind of embarrassing. Because I am mad at them, wanting to hurt them, and they get better.
I think that's another of those basic elements in magic that you kind of have to keep in mind, too, is that not everything you're trying to do is what is ultimately the best for the situation. Because if you're making a move based on your own, like, offended ego, then it's just kind of what you think they deserve that will kind of – that you're putting out there. But in reality – the situation will unfold differently, because that's not what they actually deserved. It was simply that they offended you, and, you know, maybe, like Joy said, what was meant was that their lives would improve. And, you know, it's an unfortunate thing that people are so willing to do that. I mean, I know that I've gone in, you know, out of my way trying to curse people as well. One of the first books on magic I read as a kid was Sybil Leek's Book of Curses, actually. and I loved it. I quite enjoyed that book. And Sybil Leek's one of my favorite authors from that era. But nonetheless, I mean, basically, you know, you have to sort of really evaluate your motives, because if it's just you trying to get back at someone for what they've done to you, it may not work out the way you think it's going to.
Yeah, it usually doesn't. I wound up stopping doing curses and get back at you spells like that altogether, because it never worked out. It always came back at me somehow.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, you will get it. Exactly. The whole idea behind spells, okay, is a spell, as it's presented in popular media, is something that you can do to change the universe, to make things better, to you know, create golems and create entities and kill things. What spells are actually for are prayers. That's essentially all a spell is. Everybody's prayed at some point to some deity. Okay, well, you take the deity out of the prayer, and that's what a spell is. That's it. It is you asking the universe, or you demanding the universe, give you fill in the blank. Okay?
It's true.
I mean, that's all. You know, when everybody talks about praying to Jesus for this, that, or the other, okay, all they're doing is they are saying, okay, hey, Jesus, look, I'll give you my worship if you do this favor for me, okay? And the theory behind that is you live on a physical plane. You have things that you can make, that you can do, services that you can perform for that deity that the deity cannot do for themselves. And as an exchange of you doing that for that deity agrees to do whatever you asked, okay? It's, you know, hey, can you do me a favor? I'll do you, and I'll owe you one, you know, exchange like that. It's a tit for tat. With a spell, you simply remove the deity from the equation. And you go, okay, universe, magic, everything that is out there, I want this. And I'm going to magnetize myself for this, and it's going to pull it to me. And that's essentially all that it is. So, you know, you're not talking about anything complex here, but you're talking about having to do it in very, very specific ways. Because when you remove a deity from the equation, you then get what D&D people call the wish factor, okay, where you have to be really specific about what you want and make sure there's no gray areas in there, because as soon as you leave a little wiggle room, it's going to screw you every time. With a deity, they can understand your intent. They can understand what you meant, what you didn't say. When you don't have an intelligence in there, that's gone. That safety is not there anymore. So you can wish for a blue feather all you want. And yes, the blue feather is coming to me and it's going to be here. And then you'll see it on a can instead of holding it in your hand.
That's true. It's true. It actually does. I mean, that kind of thing does happen all the time. The way a spell manifests can never actually be predicted. With enough experience, you can reduce the randomness of the effects. But again, that comes with practice, like any art does.
Mm-hmm.
You do learn to word things differently or more specifically, or, you know, to craft a spell that is more directly linked to the effect you want to bring about.
And a lot of that's practice. It's just sitting down and doing it consistently over time. I mean, I've been doing a type of spell crafting since I was 4 years old, and I'm 46 now. You know, when you start believing, okay, this is what's going to happen, and this is how it's going to happen, and you start going in your own brain and working on that, it's going to start happening. I mean, when I was little, I read about or heard about the concepts of people that protected others. And I wanted to grow up to be a powerful wizard who protected other people and took care of them and kept the bad things from hurting them. I wanted to be a super powerful psychic. And you know what? That's exactly where I'm at now. Yeah, I live in an apartment, government-controlled housing. Yes, I have a job that's just a little bit over minimum wage. But you know what? I'm on the astral plane doing that all night, every night. I'm also walking around in sacred space here on the physical plane all the time. But because I demanded it so long ago, it actually manifested. And that was a revelation that I came to not too long ago, maybe about a couple years ago. And it was just breathtaking when I realized that that's what happened. I got exactly what I wanted.
It's true. I mean, the thing too is that, I mean, a lot of people are focused on very basic rudimentary material goals when they do their first spells.
And they're very short term too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some people, I mean, you hear the stories all the time of people like wishing for money to come into their lives and, you know, maybe they get paid early, or there's a little bit extra on their paycheck that they didn't expect. Or actually, the funny thing is, when I was a kid, in the old days of bulletin board systems to access the internet, there was a little spell I came across that was claimed to be a druid money spell.
Oh, my lord.
And it basically consisted of lighting a green candle every day for a couple of weeks and chanting the word money backwards. So the spell, the mantra was Yi Nam. And the tagline at the bottom was like, within a couple of weeks, if you're persistent, you'll get an amount of money that you need. And it was like,
well, are you getting a paycheck?
Yeah, so I was like, well, that's just retarded. You know, I laughed a lot about that one because I think that's a great joke of a spell. But honestly, try for a little more than that. You know, like, if you have a job, awesome. Be able to take care of basic things. You know, your food, your shelter, you know, a little extra for cell phones or internet or whatever the hell you want. But, you know, aim a little higher with your magic so that, you know, maybe something fun will come about, you know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's having experienced some of the backlash from failed spells and some of the backlash from failed curses or curses that worked too. The fallout is really not worth the effort. I don't know how many people I see and talk to and hear about who, you know, are just mad as hell and they want this, that, and the other to occur and it's going to happen and so-and-so is going to know what it's like to feel this way, okay? And the backlash invariably is worse than the original offense. Because what winds up happening, like I said, is you start attracting all this negativity to you and you wind up in a worse position. And you really have nobody to blame but yourself. Mm-hmm. Because you're the one that wanted all of this to happen to somebody else. And while they might have felt it, while they might have gotten it, you're now in a worse position. I mean, think about all the negativity you carry around as a teenager. I don't know about you, but I was in that clique that was so far outside of all of the cliques that we had none. There were two people in it, me and my best friend, and we fit in with nobody. Everyone picked on us. I mean, the drug addicts picked on us too. We were literally the omegas of the high school pack, and we got shit from everybody. And conversely, we were also able to associate with everybody. Because we were so far outside of it, we may not be have been intimate bosom friends of people, but we were able to, you know, get with the hot chicks and say, hi, how you doing, and sit down and swap homework with them occasionally and help them out. You know, when school was over, we were ignored, and suddenly we were, you know, persona non grata. But for that little bit of time, as long as they needed something from us, we were able to associate with them. Now, change this around so that here's the spell that you have, and you are in a situation where nobody likes you. You're not friends with anyone. So you do something to try to cause somebody else to feel that way. Okay? They feel that way, but when it comes out that you're the one that did this, you're going to be even further out. The people that you used to be able to socialize with, acquaintances, are now not going to talk to you either. So now you're in a worse position. You know, and you carry all that negativity around with you when you're in high school and when you're doing stuff like that. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're thinking constantly, nobody likes me, everybody hates me, I'm going to go eat worms. And sure enough, nobody likes you, everybody hates you, and pretty soon you are going to be eating a worm.
It's true. But everyone's going to eat worms eventually.
Eventually. Be eaten by worms.
Worms will be eaten now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But see, that's the kind of thing that spells do and that magic does. Magic is not a cure-all. Magic has never been a cure-all. It has never been the overriding super weapon to fix everything. Magic is one tool in the bag of resources that you have. There are a lot of other tools that you have that are probably easier to use, less costly to use, more efficiently used, like your personality. Here's another one that I trot out anytime we have a discussion about this. You cast a spell to get a job. That's great. You cast a spell, you do the spell every single day for 3 months solid. That's fantastic. Have you gone and applied for a job? Have you sent out a resume? Have you talked to anybody? Have you looked in the want ads? Have you stopped in at a store where there's a help wanted sign? If you haven't done those basic things, which are a lot more powerful tools than the magic is, you can cast spells all year long, and they're probably a job is probably not going to fall into your lap. Okay.
Definitely. I mean, there's more power in a direct action toward a goal that you want than there is in making magical petitions for it for weeks and weeks and weeks.
There was there's a story called The Little Witch where there's four witches that come to an elder's house. It's storming outside. It's terrible. There's only room enough for one of them to sleep into bed. And so the elder says that we're going to have a little contest. I'm going to light this candle, and whoever puts it out with the best spell wins and gets to sleep on the bed. And so you can probably tell where this is going already. The first spell, the first lady, you know, casts the spell, and the winds whip around and blow the candle out. Okay, that's great. The next one, you know, focuses on the flame, and it gets so big, and it just melts, and the candle's out, and the elder's like, oh, this is great. The third person, you know, has the water from the bucket jump up and jump onto the candle and put the flame out. And the last little witch, who everybody's like, ah, she's not going to do it, she licks her fingers and pinches the flame out. And the elder's like, oh, that's the greatest spell at all. And everybody's like, what? She didn't cast a spell at all? And the lady's like, yeah, of course. Because sometimes the best spell is just plain mundane effort. And
yeah,
she's right.
Exactly.
You know, it's the greatest example of this ever. But since
well,
we were talking
about a lesson that you see in a lot of TV shows, like I think it was either Bewitched or I Dream of Jeannie, where, you know, they would make these elaborate requests for spells to do this, that, or the other, and the basic and easiest approach was just to do it, you know, as opposed to wasting a lot of time and effort, you know, scheduling the perfect phase of the moon and the perfect day and hour, you know, of the week, and, you know, getting all these tools together to create the perfect spell to do it. And it was like, well, I think a lot of people tend to forget that, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like magic is fun and useful, and, you know, the more you do it, the better you get at it. But
and
you're just going to spend all your time thinking magically and, you know, making wishes. I mean, nothing will get done. I mean, your real life will suffer.
Understand something very clearly also. The books that you read that talk about how wonderful and easy magic is are there to sell you a product, and that's the book. And they're going to present it as, you know, it's easy, fun, wonderful, and there's no consequences. Of course they're going to do that. It's slanted because they want to sell books. Duh.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Especially those, like, those ones with the cute little titles that are like a little tiny hardcover book with like 20 pages or whatever, and it's like a dozen spells to make you a sexy witch or whatever. they're obviously just a ploy, you know.
They're wanting to sell you a product. They cast a spell for money, and their mechanism for money is the book, and you are the sucker.
It's true, and you always end up paying a ridiculous amount for those ones, too.
Yeah, I saw those things for like $15 or something. It was 2 dozen spells on how to make your enemies look worse. And it's like, wait a minute. I'm trying to be a sexy person, and I guess the theory is that if everyone around me looks horrible, I look better by comparison.
Exactly. That's the way to go about it.
Yes. Mary's somewhat overweight, so she keeps trying to feed everybody, and she deflects it by saying that if everyone else gets fat, she looks thin. It's kind of funny, though. Anyway, okay, so having warned you for the first half hour of this on how horrible these spells are and giving you all kinds of dire warnings and stuff, let's go on to what is actually supposed to be happening with the spell, okay? With any spell, what you have is you have a lot of props, you have a lot of words, and you have this ceremony that you go through. Okay, you set up the props, be they incense, pictures of your beloved, candles, god figurines, mummy graveyard dirt, whatever it is, it's a prop. You put it out on your altar, you stand in front of your altar, and you get into a sacred mindset, and you chant these words while manipulating things on the altar. Okay, this is the basic structure of a spell. What these spell books don't tell you is that every single bit of that can be dispensed with except for the mindset. Okay? You don't have to have the props. You don't have to have the words. You don't have to have anything except the mindset of you want this to happen. What those props and words are for are focuses. They are ways of remember we've talked about the subconscious and how it operates off of symbols. This is where this really comes through and punches you in the gut, because the props act as representations of what you want to happen. And in the manipulation of them, you are telling your subconscious through the medium of these props that this is going to happen. And because the subconscious operates off of symbols and in a language of symbols, it gives it an extra oomph to everything rather than just saying, I want money. Because you can say, I want money all the time. But if you get green candles and you chant the word money backwards and you move the candles together around a representation of you, your subconscious sees the backwards money because it knows what the money is. It sees the green candles and it sees the green candles moving towards you and puts extra force into the willing of the money to come to you.
Exactly.
That's what you're doing. That is the whole sum total of any spell you read. Okay? What makes a good spell is using symbols that are meaningful to you. Okay. You'll see spells that say, okay, you need to get this graveyard dirt, and you need to put it with this picture of this remote location, and you need to add in the pictures of your beloved, and you need to move them all together, okay? Well, why do you have graveyard dirt? Because it's more magic. Because it's more magical? Graveyard dirt is the same dirt that you have in your backyard. If you're trying to use an item that is symbolic to your mind, wouldn't it make more sense to use something that from a place that has meaning to you? Yes, there's going to be an extra ooh factor because it's graveyard dirt. It's dirt from a graveyard. Ooh. Okay? And it's mystical.
There's mandrake root in the spell.
Or whatever. But the reason that you use odd items like that is because, once again, it says to your subconscious, this is important, this is an important symbol, pay attention to it. The problem is that if it has no personal meaning to you, it doesn't matter. I've got dirt from Stonehenge that a friend of mine sent to me. She got a little pinch of dirt out of Stonehenge right in the middle, which she's not supposed to do, and put it in a little plastic bag and sent it to me. That's great. It smells interesting. It's wonderful. I've never used it in any kind of spell that calls for dirt because it's dirt from Stonehenge. And?
And you're not going to be getting any soon.
Well, there's that,
Why
too.
Why would you waste it?
True. But if I'm going to be using it for, say, a fertility rite, I'm not going to mix that, even a tiny little bit, one flake of it in there, because the fertility of Stonehenge doesn't matter to me. The fertility of the land that I'm living on matters a hell of a lot to me. So I'm going to use dirt from the backyard.
Exactly.
I mean,
unless your yard's just got a history of brown grass and dead plants, then maybe your shiny green neighbor's yard will work better.
Well, yeah, and then there's the, you know, mundane effort thing. Have you watered your yard? Have you put down new seed? Have you tried to figure out why your yard looks poisoned? You know, there are things to fix that with. And
that's
it's
true.
Mundane effort.
Well, and again, I mean, that speaks to things in your own life, right? Like, that's very much a reality check. You know, like, is there something that you're not doing in your life that leads you to think that magic is going to fix it? What are you overlooking? Like, you know, if, for instance, you can't get a date, maybe you should bathe more. Or, you know, maybe, you know, you're just trying to fool yourself into believing that you're attracted to someone you're not. You know, like, you got to kind of look at the duh, obvious kind of reasons that something's not happening for you before you start resorting to magic.
I mean, magic is great, and like we keep saying, magic is one tool amongst many. But here's the thing. It's an old engineering saying, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
That's and, true.
You know, if all you're focusing on is using magic for everything, then every problem starts looking like the only way to solve it is magic. And that's where you really need somebody else to look at your life with you and look at it objectively and go, no, here, instead of, you know, sending out instead of casting spells for a job, you need to send out a resume. You need to apply for them. You know, you need to go out to where jobs are available and talk to people. Simple.
And sometimes too, I think one of the things that people get caught up in is the idea that they're not going to settle for something that's beneath them.
Oh, God.
In a desperate situation, don't let your ego get in the way. You know, if you need a job, settle for fast food. Settle for Walmart. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, you know, is available.
I was unemployed for 4 years, and they were some of the longest, hardest 4 years of my life. And I applied for everything. I work on computers. I diagnose and fix computer problems. Now I'm doing it with cell phones. I applied for a maid's job at a hotel, you know, which is, you know, they would call it wetback work, but, you know, it's jobs that for immigrants that no, you know, self-respecting American Western person would ever, you know, apply for. And I'm applying for these jobs. I applied at fast food places. You know, nothing was beneath me. And you can't go into it with, I want this exactly. You know, because it's not going to work. But anyway, okay, back to spells. So the basic idea is using symbols that have meaning to you. That not only applies to props, but that applies to the words too. Okay, the reason the Yinam worked is because your subconscious already knew that it was money backwards. And because you were saying it backwards, it was you were having to make an effort to do the mental flip that saying a word backwards required. Because it does take a little bit of effort too. And because you were making that additional effort, it was putting a little bit extra effort into the spell. Okay? Because essentially, like I said, essentially all a spell is you telling the universe you are going to have something. Well, you know that child stubbornness that you get when you're really little, where you are going to have this cake and nothing is going to stop you from eating this cake, no matter what? And I'm sure a few people are thinking now about a certain webcomic that I go to. But you have the stubbornness where nothing is going to stop you from achieving this goal or getting this thing. And you work on it, and you think about it, and you force with your mind to do it to the point where sometimes you get a headache because you're so locked in on getting this one thing. And when you do that, if you think back on it, most of the times you actually achieve that goal. You actually do what you wanted to do. It takes time. It takes a lot of effort. But that's what a spell is getting that single-minded, child stubborn, laser beam focus on what you're doing and using all of your tools, all of your effort, all of your will, focused on that to get what you want, okay? And we do this, there's a lot of theories on how it operates. Me being a pragmatist, I don't give a shit about the how. I just accept that it operates and I move on. But a lot of people spend great amounts of time thinking about the how. And the how theories come down to two of them, okay? The two big theories there are magnetism and ripples, okay? The first theory, magnetism, is that you focus on this so hard that you essentially become a magnet for that thing. And fate, the future, the universe, the multiverse, whatever, starts throwing it at you because you are magnetizing yourself to it and you are attracting it to you. And you are pulling this from the universe in. And you get it because you do this and you magnetize and it comes. And, you know, once you magnetize yourself to it, it's inevitable that it will come to you. There's no chance that it won't. Okay. The other theory is the ripple effect, and that is you have a still pond. Think of all the magic in the universe as being this still pond, and you touch in a very specific place in that pond. What happens? The ripples go out from where you touched, and then they reflect back when they get to the edge, or they hit other things. And when those ripples come back, you get what you want. You send out into the universe this wavelength of, I want this. And it hits other people and hits other things. And if they have the ability to give you that, it starts coming back to you reflected from them. Okay? Mm-hmm. Those are the two big theories. I mean, Brian, I don't know if you've heard any other major ones.
No, I can't say as I have.
Okay.
I mean, magic, the theory behind magic is less important, I suppose, than knowing that it works if mm-hmm. you use it. But again, as we've said before, I mean, it doesn't always work the way you think it's going to.
I tend to find the magnet theory a lot more palatable because it makes it me. It doesn't depend on anyone else. I guess the votive type of magic where you're working with gods and other entities to bring you what you want is more the ripples effect. So I like the magnetism version where my effort, my will, my power pulls it to me because it's inevitable at that point.
Well, and I kind of wonder, too, if it isn't, you know, something that happens over time. Like, perhaps the whole ripple effect approach is kind of sort of a beginner level mindset because you get a lot of those intro books to like positive thinking and visualization and, you know, all this kind of stuff that says, you know, put the vibe out there and it will manifest in your life. Whereas I think from what I've seen, at least the more advanced practitioners tend to recognize that it is the individual who is responsible for the manifestation of things they desire.
And it can, and stopping and thinking about it, it can be a combination of both. I was just thinking about this while I was describing it. You can do a magnetism on you and strive to bring it to you at the same time sending the ripples out through the aethers to other people who may have those resources to send to you. So I guess it could be a combination of both in reality. But I don't know. I'm a pragmatist. Whatever works is what I use.
I think, yeah, that's been my approach as well. I mean, and I think, okay, so, I mean, the basic rule with magic is that you have to develop the willpower to create the effect you want. Now, a lot of beginner magic books will start incorporating things like crystals or elements or incenses or deities or any number of correspondences to go along with that, which, you know, they're kind of fun. And, I don't know, I've used them occasionally.
They certainly don't hurt.
Well, yeah, and I think what they do is they reinforce your own willpower and your own effort. And I think that's kind of like the idea behind, say, using an orange or yellow candle when you have to sit down and study for a big final or whatever. I mean, using the color there is meant to reinforce you in your effort to learn, because yellow is an associated color that goes with air, which goes with intellect, you know, which obviously connects to learning and et cetera.
Which is the backwards money. It's symbols that mean something to you. But then you get I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
One of the other things that I wanted to mention is that if you're using symbols that don't matter to you, then it's not only not going to be effective, it's probably going to detract from everything. I know that in Gardnerian and some Alexandrian rituals, they have this chant of Evo Echo Akarak, Evo Echo Azeroth, I think.
I know what you're talking about. I can't think of what it is. Echo, something. Yeah.
But it's this over and over and over chant of these sounds that are meaningless. What is an Evo? Can you point to an Evo? Is it a state of being? Is it a verb or an adjective? What is it? You know, we don't know. What's an Azeroth? So, you know, all these old grimoires and stuff have this listed in there as you're supposed to say it. Well, it's noise. It's
true, actually.
Doesn't mean anything. So it's not, so when you say it, when you're chanting it, it's like, okay, the words are coming out of my mouth, and they have absolutely no meaning of any type for me whatsoever. I have no idea what I'm trying to do here. I don't know what the ceremony is about, and it just becomes doing the motions.
Well, exactly. And the interesting thing, too, is that sometimes something that has meaning for you will seem completely off the wall to someone else that you might be consulting for advice on how to cast a spell.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of, like, I actually own a little book called The Power of the Psalms, and it's actually a book that talks about how to use psalms and Bible verses as magic spells. It's fascinating. You know, it mm-hmm. goes through every psalm and it says, well, you can use these lines from this psalm to do this kind of magic. And, you know, if you read this psalm as a spell, then it'll do this for you, etc.
And Buckland's complete book, or Buckland's Practical Candle Burning Rituals, does something similar. It pulls out a pagan thought or passage and mates it with a Bible verse for everyone. So,
it's
go ahead.
True, and I think advanced candle magic, he divides the two into like sections. So you've got mm-hmm. like the pagan version, and then you've got like the Christian version, which mm-hmm. is basically like hoodoo, I guess, is probably yeah. the closest comparison to it. And, you know, again, it's a matter of finding the words and things that mean something to you. If, for instance, you can flip to a Shakespeare play and draw power out of a couple of lines of Shakespeare, then not only do you have the bonus of rhyme, but you also have words that mean something to you and will help you bring about an effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you got to understand that all of this is, like we said before, it's a tool to help your subconscious focus in on what's going on. Because here's the thing, if magic and magic spells are you magnetizing yourself to the universe, and you do that through your thoughts and will and efforts, the only ones that you can totally 100% control are the thoughts of your ego. There's been a lot of psychologists that have broken up the brain into three parts. I tend to see it as the superconscious, the subconscious, and the ego. Okay, the ego is the conscious mind. That's the part that you think with, that you walk around with, that you see things. The superconscious is the moralistic, the higher functioning, thinking, reasoning section. And the subconscious is just the garbage disposal of everything. Every action, everything that you ever do goes into there. It's the log file, essentially. But so much stuff has gone in there that it's developed its own type of function. And the subconscious never shuts down, because you go to sleep, the superconscious shuts off, you stop reasoning, you stop moralizing, you stop thinking, but the subconscious keeps dreaming and doing its job. So that's why you get dreams while you're asleep, and they make absolutely no sense. That's because it's in the language of the symbols of the subconscious. The ego, on the other hand, is the meeting point between the superconscious and the subconscious. That's what you get when you're in a conscious state, okay? So that is the only time that you can control what's going on in the subconscious, okay? Is what you're thinking about, how you're thinking about it, what's going on, what you're reasoning, what you're taking in through your senses, and that, okay? So you have a very thin band of your total spectrum of the mind where you can control what's going on in there, okay? The other two sections you can't affect except backwards. And one of the ways that you can affect the subconscious, which is the major portion of your mind, is through relating symbols that it uses to what you want to happen. So when you use poetry, yes, it makes the subconscious pay attention, because the subconscious loves poetry. It loves rhythms. It loves rhymes. using candle colors that make sense to it, using lead figures. I don't know if you know about military history, but there was a time when generals would plan out a war with, on their side at least, by using what's called a sand table. And they would make little wax or lead figurines of their troops, and they would sculpt the terrain in the sand, and they would move these troops around and go, okay, well, if they go here, we're going to do this, and then we're going to move over here, and this legion's going to come in, and they're going to attack here and do that. And they would plan out how the war was going to go, and then they would work really hard when they were actually out on the battlefield to have it go that way. Well, in using the terrain and the figurines, they're talking to their subconscious again in the language of symbols, and the subconscious is cooperating to force their will of this is how this war is going to go out into the universe and magnetize themselves to that. Make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And for those who don't already know, the sand table concept is probably the precursor to the plastic toy soldiers.
Most likely.
of little boys, because who doesn't love those? You know, G.I. Joe figures were all over the place. We used to do huge battles with them. But nonetheless, I mean, basically, yes. The idea is spell work is like creating a battle plan and outlining how it's supposed to go. Now, where do we want to go from here, Joy? Because, I mean, we've talked about the basic idea that willpower is probably fundamental to every spell. The basic idea that using tools has to be, using magic has to be secondary to the basic mundane pragmatic performance of things to provide for what you need. Where do we want to go from there?
Well, mostly what I'd like to do is talk about specifics. You had your user write in about magical entities. I'm pretty sure I know the book that she's referencing because I've reviewed it. It's called Creating Magical Entities, oddly enough.
What a strange idea.
I'm telling you. And there's a webinar on DVD that comes along with it. They're really, really good, but they do tend to give you a skewed version of things. One other thing that I do want to mention, and this is relating back to the odd words, there's one time that I can think where words that have no meaning to you actually do matter. There's a ritual in Kabbalistic practice called, and the Golden Dawn, called the banishing ritual of the pentagram. There's the banishing ritual of the hexagram. There's several others like that. And in the process of this, you are saying this word that has nothing to do with anything out loud during the ritual. Okay? What the books and the online descriptions of this do not tell you is that there is a time when you are saying it, but you're drawing it out like an om in meditation. You know how you go, om. You are drawing that sound out, and you are trying to get it to vibrate down through your body. Because when you just say a sound, it's, you know, quick and over with. But if you chant it like that and intone it, they call it vibrating. What it does is it starts going through your body and vibrating and changing the aura state that you're in, which is the point of doing that. The word itself has no meaning to you. It couldn't matter less, but there's an actual physical effect by doing that. That is about the only time where the words do actually matter.
That's true, actually.
Yeah.
Because I think about it in terms of the Sanskrit om, which everyone's pretty much familiar with who does yoga or has any connection to Eastern spirituality.
Or even watches TV.
or watches TV. but then I think too about like in Druidry, we use the word Awen in the same fashion to draw out and, you know, create that vibrating state. Instead of speaking from what I tend to refer to as the head voice, which is, you know, that upper register, upper back of the throat kind of deal.
The one that's in the nasal, in the sinuses.
Yeah. You basically drop it into, like, your vocal cords and, you know, your upper chest. And it becomes this, like, all-body vibrating thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use... There's a variety of words you can use, but you kind of have to figure it out because not all of them work the same way.
No.
A
lot of Christian groups use amen the same way.
Do they really?
Yeah, there's
I suppose you could, but I've never actually heard a Christian group do that.
Actually, not just speaking it, they sing it in the hymns. Amen.
Yeah, I guess in the liturgies, they do tend to use it like that. Although I don't think most Christians are conscious that they're doing it in that.
No, I don't think
so. That effect, because it's such an exoteric tradition that like they don't want to tell you why you're doing things the way you're doing them.
A lot of priests I've found don't even know why you're doing it. It's only when you start looking at the roots of ritual and the hows and whys that you start discovering that there are other uses for this stuff. It's kind of like Christianity became spellcrafting light. They don't tell you why, but they just say, do this, and this works.
Well,
I don't know.
you look at, like, the Pentecostals, who are all about what are, you know, basically, like, shamanistic practices. Chanting, dancing, you know, it's all about trance work, but they don't recognize it as such as much as, you know, like they don't recognize it as a comparable state to something that you would find in, like, the, I don't know, let's say in Siberia or in, like, Native America somewhere.
Scandinavia.
Because they're just told that this is all about Christian, you know, belief, and it's the Holy Spirit that's moving you and stuff, and it's so that they're kept in the dark about the practices that they are involved with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. There's a dissatisfaction after a while, though, because once again, it's a lot of people get into religions like that because they want to advance themselves, because they want to become better people. And when kept at the 101 level constantly, they get really dissatisfied because there's no growth beyond that. And for many people, that's fine. And, you know, if that's what they want, hey, no problem. Let's keep you there, and you can just be one of the worshipers. That's not a problem. There are people who want to advance and want to improve themselves. Just as an aside, that's what the search for transmuting lead to gold in alchemy is all about. It's transforming the lead of the base person into the gold of an ascended master. It's not actually transforming the metal, physical element lead into...
Although the sleight of hand element was certainly fun and kept an alchemist being paid while he was doing his job.
Oh, yes.
but yeah, I mean, actually, that's one of the fun things about learning alchemy and spagyrics as well, is that you do recognize the very real practices of transmutation, not as the base metals to gold kind of thing, but as, you know, a matter of changing the, you know, that human ego into an advanced spiritual developed being.
Oh, and you want to talk about a language of symbols? Alchemy is your thing. I'm, you know, red lions and white elephants and just everything that you can possibly imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jung's red book, Liber Novus, was all about that. You know, I still actually want to spend the ridiculous amount of money to buy the version with the artwork and calligraphy, because
yeah, that would be really interesting to see.
Cool, but holy crap. But yeah, I mean, if you look into alchemy, even online, you'll find pictures that make no sense if you don't understand the arcane language of alchemy. Mm. You'll see like dragons in vessels, and you'll see like butter churns and these sort of things, you know, and they're all very comparable to better known symbols that you'll find in like Eastern mysticism or whatever. Mm. And yeah, I mean, if you're into that sort of complex symbolism, alchemy is a fascinating way to go.
Oh, it is.
But
you know, there's legendary monsters in there. The hippocampus. The hippocampus is a combination of a number of different creatures, but in alchemy, it was used as a way to disguise the fact that they were talking about the combination of water, fire, water, air, and earth, all in one. So they would be talking about that, and they would be actually referring to something else. And it's just fascinating when you get into it. But anyway,
well, okay, one more little animal symbol that I personally happen to think is cool is the dragon. It's actually a representation of the quintessence. It's the harmony between all four elements, in the fact that the claws grasp the earth, the scales represent, you know, the fish or water. The dragon breathes fire, and then it beats the air with its wings.
Mm-hmm.
So that itself is a harmony between all four elements, and representative of the fifth element, which is the quintessence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and realize that when we're talking about this stuff, we're not talking about the actual creatures. Okay, we're talking about the symbols as they were used in the context of the alchemy. Because dragons exist, I work with them nightly. Sometimes they can be really irritating, but they really are out there. They're not on this physical plane, but when they're talking about dragons in the context of alchemy, it means what Brian was saying.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
So don't ever make that mistake and think that, oh, well, dragons don't exist because they're here. Our belief in them, our persistent dedication to, yes, dragons are real, has created them out of the past. And even if that hadn't done it, the fact that they were here before us and will be here after us had them created anyhow. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm getting hit by some of my dragons to make sure that y'all understand this.
No worries.
You know, it's a case of either we created them or not, and it's the same case that can be made for deities. And it's, I don't know, it's okay.
And I mean, even the symbol of a unicorn has profound meaning behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of people are used to seeing them as just magical creatures with rainbow tails and things like that. But seriously, unicorns are a crazy animal, and they are very cool.
Think about the fact that they're part goat, they're part lion, they're part horse, they're part deer. They have an extremely phallic symbol on them. They are white, and they're associated with purity. Okay?
It's true. Well, and the weird thing is they're associated with maidens, who are the only ones who are supposed to be able to find them in nature. And realistically, then, what you're speaking of is a sexual awakening, because you know, the phallic unicorn and the virgin maiden who's gone looking for it. It's all crazy symbolism that means way cool things.
And all these combinations of animals that are associated with virility. Every single one of them is, you know, seen as a sexual powerhouse. So you've got a unicorn that is, you know, a blossoming from maidenhood to womanhood, literally. And
and the interesting thing, too, is, I mean, the whole theme of that, like the unicorn's horn itself, is seen as having the power to to heal and cure and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into like Tantra and Western sexual mysticism, and it relates the whole concept of transmutation of sexual energy into, you know, creating a whole being, basically the foundation of the formation of a soul.
Mm-hmm.
And here we go,
segueing right into the next section that I wanted to talk about. So go ahead, finish out.
Excellent. It's just really fascinating. Like when you touch on even the basics of magic, you'll be forced out of, you know, just because books will tell you these things, to look into different animal symbolisms and magical creatures and things that we're told in common, you know, consensus reality that don't exist. But when you actually get down to the working of magic and alchemy and all these other spiritual disciplines that will enhance you in profound ways, I mean, you get into some deep level magic shit that is way cool.
Oh yeah. It's a fascinating science to get into, and I class magic and the study of magic as a science because it is both an art and a science. There are replicable results. Science says that if you do A, two thing B, you will get C result, okay? And it's replicable, and you can do it over and over and over again, okay? With magic, that is very true. If you do the same thing over and over again, in the same way, you will get the same results. So in that, it is a science. It's, you know, very laid out. But it's also an art form in that you're dealing with a lot of various variables to that that can completely screw it up. So you do the same thing to whatever to bring the predictable result, but one day you're in a very good mood, up and cheery and happy, and it works, and 3 days later you're pissed as hell, and you go into it, and you do it, and it fails. So you've got that variable as well, you know, so it is an art form in that there are elements that get affected not only by you, but your environment, and variables that you can't control. Because, I mean, if a scientist goes in and does a catalyst thing with these two elements in a beaker, it doesn't matter whether he's pissed off or he's happy or he's got a blue shirt on or a red one. It's going to have the same effects. But an artist goes into a painting and he can paint the exact same painting from one day to another. If he's mad one day and happy and cheerful the next, there's going to be a difference in the painting. You're going to see it. You're going to feel it. And that's what makes it an art. So having talked about extraplanar entities, to answer the kid's question who was talking about creating magical entities, yes, it is possible. Yes, it is done. It is advanced magic. I'm going to say the precursor to it is mid-level magic, and then creating them from whole cloth is advanced magic. Because essentially what you're doing is you are taking the energies of your will and your desires. You are manifesting them in an astral form, like a ghost, and putting a personality with it and giving it an instruction that it will do X. Okay.
Exactly.
And that's what that is. Now, as we've been saying with the art form, your attitude going into it can change the outcome massively. Just something as little as thinking a stray thought that has nothing to do with the ritual that you're focused on can cause this change. All right? And I know this because I've created a number of magical entities. Okay. There was one that I wound up creating that I wanted to do nothing but go out and find information on me in the astral world. in addition, let's back up for just a second. In addition to magic being encompassing everything and touching everything and being everywhere and being the still pond, we've also got it being the biggest library you ever wanted to find in the universe. Okay, it is literally the Akashic Record. In some of the Eastern teachings, the Akashic Record is a record of everything that has happened, everything that will happen, everything that could happen, everything that has happened on all the multiverses, everything that has happened in all of the might have beens with the multiple worlds theories, everything that has happened everywhere since forever.
Well, and I think the Western equivalent of that is the collective unconscious.
Right, which only goes back to the oldest living person.
I suppose that's true as well. But even then, I mean, the fact that only humans remember it, you know, to that point doesn't speak, you know, of the fact that it didn't pre-exist humanity.
True. But the point is that the two records are different. One is the collective unconscious is easier to access just walking around all the time. If you close your eyes and meditate for a few moments about a subject, if somebody that is alive on the planet knows about it, you will start getting that information, and you will start having UPG. Okay? If you, however, start meditating and thinking about how the dinosaurs died, however, you won't get that from the collective unconscious. You're going to have to go into a deep meditation and access the Akashic Record, because that is where that information is stored. Nobody alive knows how they died. Okay, because obviously they died. So there's theories.
What? Dinosaurs died?
Yeah, it's incredible. They have theories, they have thoughts, they have ideas, they have suppositions, but they have no fact on what exactly happened. And
well,
personally,
you can't look for physical evidence of something like that.
Right. So it's not going to be this is definite how they died. It's going to be more along the lines of this is how they think they died. And to find out the actual answer of how they did die, in fact, you have to access the Akashic Record. But anyway, talking about magical entities, sending that entity out to look through the collective unconscious and find out who was, you know, working against me in a couple of jobs that I had, who were trying to set me up to fail, so that I could be aware of those pitfalls and avoid them. I made this servitor to do that. It's called a servitor. Some people call it a thought form. Other people call it deities, and very angels, teachers, guides, whatever you want to call it as. They're all a name for a being that dwells only on the astral plane and does what you want them to do. Okay? You create it out of your thoughts. You will it into being and give it a task. In D&D terms, it would be called an automaton, an unseen servant, sometimes a ghost. I tend to just think of it as a thought form. That's the easiest term for me, because it is a form of my thoughts. My thoughts have formed this and put a shape to it and given it a task to do.
Well, exactly. And I mean, even in Kabbalistic circles, I mean, we talk of golems, you know, and, you know, there's a story back in the 16th century, I think, of a Jewish dude who created a golem in Poland, and you know, he sent it around to do his bidding because he didn't like how things were working out, so he sent it around to kill people and stuff. And I tend to think that golems are the same kind of thing, except maybe manifested on more of a physical level.
Yeah, understand, you can create anything with your thoughts on the astral plane that you care to. A lot of people do without even thinking about it, mainly because they don't realize that they have that power and that they have to watch what they think. And so they're, you know, imagining a, let's take something simple, a sword that they want to create for SCA. And they'll plan it out and they'll sculpt it in their head and everything will be, you know, exactly the way they want it, and then they'll release it. Okay, just daydreaming, not really thinking about anything. Well, guess what? They just created a thought form on the astral plane of a sword. It's a beautiful sword. It's exactly like they want it. They can use that sword anytime they go to the astral plane if they think about it. But a lot of people don't think about that. So your fantasies and imaginations become reality on the astral, because the astral touches everything and is everything and has all the magic on it and everything like that. And we're getting into advanced worlds theory here, but this impinges on magic because it is interconnected. So your thoughts become reality there, and what you think about becomes reality there. So when you're fantasizing about the little French maid coming up and, you know, and stripping in front of you, that on the astral plane, that now actually exists, and you are now responsible for that thing, and you can, you know, give it a purpose, you can get rid of it or whatever. So remember to put your toys away.
Exactly.
Okay.
While you're crafting that sword, don't forget the scabbard to go with it.
Exactly, or else you'll just have sort of a sword floating there in the astral hurting people. But yeah, anyway, so doing that, you do have now a responsibility to them, because you have taken something that didn't exist and now given it an existence. Okay, now that is a simple repetitive task machine, an automaton. Like that. There are times when you need an entity that can think on its own and can discriminate things and can figure out answers to questions that you have and ask the questions that you would ask were you there to ask them. And in that case, you're going to need an intelligent entity. And when you start thinking about something like that, it usually turns out to be something along the lines of an invisible friend who can relate to you. What winds up happening is you pull an actual soul from, the Christians call it the guff, but I call it just the collective pool that we were talking about last time with the shape changers in DS9, remember that? You grab a consciousness from there and pull them into a physical form. Okay, and this is what I've done, what I did with the entity I wanted to, you know, keep an eye out for my interests. And she does. She's a really good, very solid performer, very nice person. And when I started talking to her about this and about the creation existence, because she knows that I created her, she says, you know, look, I was floating in this pool of everything, and there were all kinds of people around me, and then I felt this hand come up and grab me and drag me out of that and put me into this form. You know, and I don't mind it. She's not upset about it. She has no problem with doing it. She enjoys it. But, you know, when I realized that it was pulling an actual consciousness from someplace and not just creating a consciousness, I was horrified. I mean, how would I feel if I were laying in this nice warm pool with lots of friends around me and some claw came out of the sky and grabbed me? I'd be pretty offended, wouldn't you? So
I imagine I would.
That's something else you gotta consider, is, you know, the effects on the entities that you're creating yourself. And then, here's another thing. You create an entity. It's out there. It's running around. It's doing what you want. You're now 90 years old. And it's still running around out there doing what you want. You die. And you know what? It's still out there running around doing what you want because you gave it an independent existence. So now what do you do? How do you get rid of it? Is there a time that you should get rid of it? Do you need to feed it? Is it just going to disappear on its own, or, you know, do you have to go in and actually disassemble it and deconstruct it? These are other things that you have to think about. Is it going to die at some point and become another soul lost like a ghost? You know, your favorite stuffed animal. You gave it so much love and so much attention and so many of your secrets and everything. I will guarantee you that if you go find your beloved stuffed animal and pick it up and hold it, you will feel the exact same way that you felt when you were holding it when you were little, because you created a thought form of your stuffed animal, put love and concern and care into it, and wanted love and willpower and concern and attention from it and compassion, and you got it. Well, 30 years later, when you don't need it anymore, it's still there, waiting for to give you that love and concern and compassion. So do you kill it? Do you just dismiss it? Do you say, I don't need you anymore? What do you do then? And these are things that you got to think about when you start working with thought forms and servitors and stuff. Okay? You can't just go out and create a magical entity, a non-bodied entity, without considering this stuff. Because your goal is to make a thoughtful, independent, intelligent entity to do what you want it to do. Well, once you make it a thoughtful, intelligent, independent entity, you've got to figure out its entire life. You have literally just become Yahweh to that entity.
That's true.
So you've got to provide for it. You've got to figure out what's going on. You've got to help it. You can't direct its life. But if you give it, you know, independent thought and the ability to choose its own destiny, guess what, deity? You just did it.
That's an interesting point, actually. You are the god.
Just because it doesn't have a body doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. And this is something that I work all the time to try to get across to people. If you create something, if you make something along these lines, you are responsible for it for the rest of its existence. I learned these lessons 10 years ago, 15 years ago, screwing around, not really thinking about what I was doing, and a lot of people got hurt. And I feel very, very bad about it, and I've done my best to fix it since then. Learn from my mistakes, please. Understand that when you do something like this, when you have a fantasy, when you're telling a story in your head and the scene shows up around you and you can see it and you can see your characters moving around and you throw a terrible thing at them, out on another planet on the astral in one of the pieces of the multiverse, that's actually just happened to somebody. And you are now God, manipulating those little people around like your puppets, and making them do things. Same thing with D&D. I had so many people coming at me going, Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing is a piece of crap. There's no redeeming value for it at all. But I'll tell you what it does. It gives you visualization tools like you would not believe.
Because yeah, definitely. I was just thinking that. It does train your mind to like visualize things and you know, hold thought patterns and
And describe things so that other people can understand what you're talking about. Because you can't be unclear. If you say, okay, you walk into a room, it's 10 by 10, the walls are dank and they're weeping water, and you guys are clustered around the door and you see an ogre. Well, the very first question that pops into your head is, well, where is the ogre? What position in the room is it? But if you say you walk in and you guys are clustered around the door and the ogre is standing on the opposite side of the room in front of the only other door leaving, you have a fairly clear idea of where that is now. And you then have an idea of how you can maneuver in this room to defeat it.
That's true.
Okay, so
especially if you've got a party of four and
yeah.
You're trying to fit into this 10 by 10 room with like pikes and axes and things that require a lot of space.
So you learn how to describe things like that, and you learn how to write stories in your head as using D&D is wonderful. D&D and any role-playing game is wonderful training for storytelling. And in a lot of cases, it's wonderful training for visualization and creation magics. Okay. My gaming group, at a place called Dragonware Hobbies in Conyers, Georgia, there were about 60 of us. And I'm in contact with most of them still. And it's interesting. Of those 60 people, at least 50 of them had some kind of understanding of esoteric religions or metaphysics in general. Of which, 30 of them, half, were actual practitioners of some version of it. And of that 30, 12 of them were extremely powerful magicians and metaphysicians, either in psychic abilities, magicians, or just as priests and priestesses of their various covens and groups.
Huh.
Now, when you think about that, amongst a pool of 60 people, 12 of them, over 12.5%?
20% of the population.
That's 20% of the population collected in just a gaming group. And when you think about, when you compare that to the general standard population of the world, you're lucky if you find one person of that level in every 100,000 people. So you got this amazing concentration of people in role-playing groups, and they don't even realize it because they're attracted to it anyway. They're already doing it, and this is just another tool to help hone their skills. It was incredible when I came to that realization. It was like it was one of the light bulb UPG moments. It was really neat. Anyway, so... So that's Spellcrafting 301.
But yeah, I mean, we were planning on doing other episodes related to spellcrafting as well. So we will be talking about, like, I don't know, energy and maybe some basic spellcrafting or... you know, something along that line in another episode.
Yeah, we do definitely. We've got the next two episodes planned out, but because I don't know what order you're listening to these in, the next episode is most likely going to be our Ostara episode, since it falls right near that holiday. The one after that is going to be energy work and elements and associations of all of those together. And that's the plan for now. But like any battle, plans seldom survive the first contact with the enemy. So this is subject
True.
To change. Anyhow.
Well, and I'm wondering if... Are we doing episodes the second and fourth week of each month now, or are we doing them the first and third, in which case we...
We're doing them every other week.
Okay.
So there's 52 weeks in a year. We're doing 26 episodes a year, and even though there's only 2 months or 12 months, that's going to mean 2 months have three episodes in them.
Okay. I was just making sure.
Yeah.
Because it's like we weren't certain of that before. We were pretty sure we were just doing like two episodes a month, and that's just how it was going to be.
No, I like the two-week episode cycle, mainly because it's a lot of work on the front end to get the show recorded, and then I have to spend like 4 hours editing it and then getting it uploaded. But once it's up there, it's new for everybody. It's good. I have a week off that I can just go, huh, and sort of flake out. And then we can, you know, start getting ready for the next one.
Well, yeah, and I think that the regular pace of bi-weekly episodes does give us that chance to sort of know that there's an episode coming and know when it's coming instead of having it be up in the air and, you know, not exactly certain of that and so on. So,
and with the 2-hour format, I mean, this gives us enough time to actually get into the guts of the topic and talk about the stuff that isn't covered in, you know, an easy 30-minute lesson.
True.
So with, you know, an extended format like this, we do actually have to have time off, not only to research, but to refresh our own minds, come up with ideas for what to talk about during the 2 hours, because mostly we have a schedule. of what we're going to talk about in each episode. Today we didn't. It's all been, you know, kind of out there.
You've noticed that already. Listened to the episode.
Oh, yes. And so, you know, if it were a half hour every week, that would be one thing, and we could cover, you know, a lot more topics, but it wouldn't be nearly as in-depth.
It's true.
So the trade-off from every week is, you know, every other week for 2 hours. And I'd rather...
too, that we're going to make some effort within the next couple of months to bring on people like Lupa or Galina Kraskova again, because we had lots of fun with her on our Northern Tradition episode.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get Maat of cybercoven.org on here to talk to us about magic and rituals through the internet.
That would be interesting, because I'm not familiar with that website, and I'm not really familiar with cyber magic, so...
Yeah. It's one of the things that I've been delving into for a long time, and I want to get involved in it, but circumstances have conspired against me to keep me from doing something along those lines. But then
your
life
kicked your ass.
Oh, God, yes.
It plus, happens.
Plus, both of us also have full-time jobs. So
this is also true.
So if you want to help out at all, we have donation buttons on the website, magicalmusings.net. We take PayPal donations, Joy at magicalmusings.net and Brian at magicalmusings.net. Please come check out the website. We have all of our episodes archived there, along with episodes of Tarot Talk, where we pontificate for 2 hours on tarot cards, and then, well, we pontificate for an hour on tarot cards and then riff for an hour.
It's true. That's more accurate. And it was the riffing in Tarot Talk that actually brought about Magical Musings. So.
Oh, yes. Because we realized that we do talk, you know, over each other and with each other really well. And we both have enough experience that we could carry a show like this.
Yeah. If you want to learn more about all the weird, wild stuff we've been up to over the, you know, years of our personal practices, hit the Tarot Talk episodes, listen to the stuff about the cards and that sort of thing, and then listen to the extra hour of stuff that we talk about that has nothing, in quotes, to do with tarot, that we relate to tarot, because everything does relate to tarot.
The tarot, yes, it always does. That was the tagline, everything relates to tarot. So let's see, that should be it for this week, this 2 weeks. If you like the episode, if you like the show, if you like what we continue to do, donations are wonderful, but more than that, tell your friends, get them to listen to us.
Send us feedback.
Please.
We love hearing about things that we suck at or things that, you know, we're great at.
Mm-hmm.
It's helpful for us to know what you're into and what's not working for you,
mm-hmm.
so that we can adjust accordingly.
We have no way of tracking our listeners. We don't have, you know, the things that put cookies on your site. We don't have any way of knowing who is listening and how many people are listening. There's a page counter that is on the website, but that only counts the number of times that a page is loaded. Okay? That can be loaded by robots. And I think it has been several times by, you know, a number of robots, because we got 1,500 hits on one episode and 5 hits on the next. You know, so it's like, what? So, yeah, let us know. Share it with your friends. Come tell us. We've got ways to get in touch with us on our website. We've got email addresses. We've got our personal blogs. His is cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com. Mine is wide-worlds-joy.tumblr.com. I've also got my main website at aaronsjournal.com. You know, we've got presences on Facebook. If you search for Joy Philip, you'll probably find me on Facebook. I'm sure if you search for Cosmic, whatever.
Well,
Rebirth on Facebook.
I do have a Woodwuss radio page from my, you know, from the previous site that we were hosting Tarot Talk on. But otherwise, I don't really use Facebook, so don't even bother bugging me on there. and Joy's been a tarot reader for like 20,000 years.
No, not
that long.
So
if you want to like schedule a tarot reading, you can actually email and make arrangements to have one done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got fairly competitive prices too. Typically, tarot readings go for $1 a minute. I'm right around in there. I've got one that takes 2 hours. It's never taken less than 2 hours to do the reading, and I charge $90 for it. So, yeah, it's really comprehensive and really long. But anyway, anything else from you, Brian?
Not so far. Okay. If you guys need advice on book recommendations or any kind of weird, wild stuff you want to know about, ask us. Mm-hmm. We're happy to provide information for you.
Yep. And we won't make fun of you either.
That's true.
The only stupid question really is the unasked one. And we may laugh because it's a basic question that we asked ourselves at one point, but we won't make fun of you about it. So, you know,
we don't judge you for being a beginner. We won't, you know, we won't mock you for trying to incorporate 1,000 different spiritual traditions into your personal practice.
The only time we will mock you is if you are being deliberately idiotic and asking us a question and then completely ignoring everything that we said and doing it anyway. Then we'll
make
fun of you.
I've had people do that to me. Brian, I'm having this problem in my life. Can you tell me how to do a spell to fix it? And I'll go into great detail about all sorts of stuff to cast the perfect spell as I see it. And they'll go, well, I have my own thing, so I'm going to do that instead. And then I'm like, why did I spend all that time then? You know, and then they cast it, and then they come back at me with,
it didn't work.
I tried to cast a spell, and it didn't work right.
Yes, then we will mock you unashamedly.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if you went to the trouble of asking me how to outline a specific spell and then just did your own thing, and it failed, don't blame me. Mm. I have no control over what you did. You know, I told you how to do it, so that's how it goes.
We will help you out as much as you need us to.
Yes.
But, you know, if we spend our time doing something like this where we tell you exactly what's going to happen, why it's going to happen, and what the possible outcomes are, and then you completely ignore us and do it anyway, then, yeah, we're going to make fun of you. Probably in the privacy of our own heads, but you're still going to be made fun of.
It's true. You'll be made fun of on the astral by an invisible crowd of thought forms that were created for that specific.
So, okay. 2 weeks from now, tune in. We'll be talking about something, and it will always be fun. Talk to you later, people.
Exactly. Bye-bye, people.